Teach Me to Code, episode 39. Hey everybody, and welcome back to the Teach Me to Code podcast. This is your host, Charles Max Wood, and this week we're going to be talking to Ben Curtis. He's a Rubyist. He's been around for a while. He did the Rails kits and several other things, and we'll get into that in the interview. But anyway, I just want to remind you that this podcast is sponsored by New Relic. New Relic is some great application management tool that you can use in your Ruby or Java application. I think they're branching out into some other technologies like PHP or .NET, so go check them out at www.newrelic.com. See what they can do for you. And then we're also sponsored by Chargeify, so if you have a recurring payment scheme that's going on with your application, then go check them out. They help manage all of that stuff. They also do one-off charges and all kinds of stuff, so if you're looking for a service that has an easy-to-use API, then I highly recommend them. I do have a few announcements. I did miss a week last week. As some of you may know, I went freelance and things just got kind of crazy there. So anyway, I'm back this week and, you know, just want to apologize for that. But we will stay on track with this. I also want to let you know that by the time this is released tomorrow, I'll probably be on an airplane to New Orleans, so I want to thank everybody who contributed to that to help me go, especially June Yu over at rubyhead.com. He actually covered the hotel, which is quite a large expense, and so I'd like to thank him. Also, you can go and take the survey that I have up. It's 4 questions, and really it's just a way for me to know what kind of content you're looking for from me. So if you go check it out at teachmetocode.com/survey, I'm giving away to 10 people who take the survey. I'm giving 5 Peep Code videos and 5 Pragmatic Programmers books or videos. And so anyway, go sign up, go fill out the newsletter. And anyway, I'll be announcing the winners next week. The survey will be available through the end of this week, and then I will probably be shutting it down. But I really appreciate all the feedback that I've been getting from that. Finally, go leave a review in iTunes. If you go to teachmetocode.com/podcast and click on the little iTunes logo, it'll take you right into iTunes. You can subscribe there, and you can also leave us a review, or if you want to just email me and give me some feedback, I'd appreciate that too. It's chuck@teachmetocode.com. And without any further ado, we will get into the interview with Ben, and I'll just catch you briefly on the other side. Hey everybody, this is Charles Max Wood with Teach Me to Code, and I'm here with Benjamin Curtis. Ben is somebody that you might know if you've used any of the Rails kits, or if you've gone to agilewebdevelopment.com and looked at the Ruby on Rails plugins directory. He's also responsible for Tesly, which I haven't used and I'm a little curious about. And he's got a few other things going on, like Catch the Best. And it looks like he's actually built a site that I thought would be really fun to put together called Conference Meetup. And so we'll probably go into all of that with him. But thanks for coming on the show, Ben.
Oh, my pleasure.
So why don't we talk about Rails kits? I think that's probably one of the most well-known things that you've done. What kind of prompted that?
Well, back in 2007, I was working on Catch the Best and building that in Rails. And it's a subscription, you know, it's a SaaS business, and it needed a billing system. And there wasn't really anything out there for Rails at the time that made it easy to do recurring billing on a monthly basis like your typical SaaS app. And so I wrote all that code for Catch the Best, and then I had a client who also wanted to build a SaaS app, and they wanted to do recurring billing, and so I took the code that I'd written for myself and cleaned it up some and used it in their project. And then I figured, well, that was kind of painful and not a whole lot of fun, and I figured if I could save some people that pain, they would be interested in paying for that. So I tidied up the code, and I packaged it up, and that was the first Rails kit. That was the SaaS kit. And people loved it. It was great, and people still love it. They're still buying it, and it's since then there have been some other options that come out, but still it's nice to have a set of code that you can use as a starting point. You don't have to worry about writing all that billing code, which is not fun and not particularly exciting.
Yeah, that's true. And you know, I was actually looking through some of these, and you know, you've got a Facebook one, a Shopify one, Google Map. I mean, some of these are just really, you know, things that people would really want to add to their application. And I know that the SaaS app is something that I'm interested in personally, but you know, you've got the content management one, which is also just, you know, it seems like something that's really nice. And OpenID or open authentication, you know, that's another kind of hot topic right now. So, yeah, some great stuff here.
Yeah, it's the, a lot of things that I wanted to build were things that are, you know, kind of the plumbing, you know, and that's one of the reasons why I love Rails, because so much is already done for you. And so, you know, Rails kits is all about, well, giving you a little bit more that's done for you so you can focus on what's really interesting or important about your particular app.
And before we started the interview, you know, I asked you a little bit about it, and you mentioned that developers, you know, a lot of these are things that developers can kind of do on their own. In fact, in my particular case, you know, a lot of times I'll spend a ton of time building something like this, and then I'll find out, oh, I could have just gone and got a Rails kit, or you know, gone and used this other library or something for it. And you know, and you mentioned something about you know, developer time versus the money it costs, and you know, you want to explain a little bit about that?
Sure. You know, when I first launched Rails kits, I actually wondered to myself if anybody would buy it, because I'm a developer and I know my natural tendency is if I want something, I just go and build it. And you know, I kind of prefer my code to other people's code, and I think most developers are that way. But as I built the SaaS kit, and I realized just how much work went into that. And I thought, you know, there's a lot of time invested in this code, and if I could save someone else that time, then it's probably worth what I'm charging for it. And what I found is a lot of developers get that, and they're like, oh yeah, I can spend that, save all my time, and that's not, and I'll just drop that code in there. And other developers are still like, well, I don't know, I can build it. And it's true. I think most developers can build that. It's not, you know, it's not like rocket surgery or anything, but sometimes we as developers, we tend to value our time at zero. We think that our time, you know, is not really worth anything. And if we spend a week on something or 3 weeks on something, well, that's better than spending, you know, $250 or whatever. And sometimes that's not quite right. Sometimes our time does have value, and we can save a lot of time by either buying, you know, Rails kits or by using great libraries that are already out there. And we don't necessarily have to write everything ourselves all the time.
Yeah, that's really the case. I think in a lot of cases, I mean, if you look at these, like I looked at the software as a service, and I think it's listed for like $249 for a single site. You know, and if you think about your time, you think about how much you get paid, you know, and if you want to break that down, you just take your salary and you divide it by 2,000, you get pretty close to your hourly rate. You know, if you multiply that out, say you're getting paid, you know, $40 or $50 an hour, I mean, that's 4 or 5 hours, you know, and it's clearly going to take you much longer to build something like this. So, you know, from a time cost analysis, you know, something like this really is worth it.
And I've even had some people tell me, a number of people tell me actually, they bought the kit with no intention of actually putting that in their app, but they wanted to see how it was done so that they could go and write their own version more quickly. You know, they could. I don't know if you've had this experience, but I've seen a lot of times when I build something, if I have a good example of how to do it, then I can, even if I do it myself, I can do it faster because I see, you know, the basic logic and how somebody else approached the problem. And so I've had a number of people tell me they did that they just use it as a learning tool so they could write their own faster.
Yeah, and you know, I'm the same way. You know, a lot of my videos, in fact, on Teach Me to Code, you know, I went and I, you know, I pulled some code, you know, that did the same thing, you know, probably a couple of different examples, you know, took the pieces I liked from it, and then record the screencast, you know, with a coherent solution. And you know, it's the same kind of thing. You know, if you've done it before, then it makes it a lot easier. But if you haven't done it before, but if you've seen it before, that it still, you know, reduces the learning curve as opposed to just making it up from scratch. Yeah, that's it's a fascinating thing, and it's an argument, I think, for reading code. You know,
Definitely.
I've seen people argue both ways. You know, well, don't waste your time reading code versus, you know, you really ought to be reading other people's code. And I think honestly, the people who say that it's a waste of time just haven't been reading the right code.
Yeah, that's probably true. In fact, I have a faker gem that generates fake data for you. It's really helpful if you're, you know, building out your app and you want to see some real data in your app without having to do a lot of data entry. And when I first did it, I did it as a port from the Perl Faker library. I just basically, you know, copied the code over almost literally and just made it Rubyfied instead of Perlified. And someone later went in and actually did another copy of that gem and made it faster and took a slightly different approach. And, you know, going back and reading that other person's code, I'm like, yeah, that's some good stuff. I should incorporate those changes back into mine. So, and I will. It's on my to-do list. I haven't gotten to it yet. But yeah, definitely looking at other people's code. I think John Nunemaker had a great blog post about this a while back. Definitely helps you learn. I think you help yourself by seeing what other smart people are doing instead of always thinking you have to do everything yourself.
Yeah, it's so true, you know. And I think that's true in a lot of other areas too, not just writing code. I mean, when you look at design patterns and things like that, you know, you see what these other folks have done and you can follow those. Or, you know, we've had a million different documentation libraries that all kind of do the same thing, and they're taking all the great ideas from one person and putting it into their own thing. Even if they're not really looking at the code, they're looking at the concept and taking advantage of that. And I really think that there's a lot to that. Now, I also wanted to ask you about the Agile Web Development site that you have.
Yeah, that started actually back with the Canada on Rails conference, which was like the first, I guess, exclusively Rails conference. I think that's back in 2006. And what DHH was up there talking about plugins, and you know, I had done a bit of work with Rails by that point, and I had felt the pain of the wiki solution at the time, and it just wasn't. He kept on emphasizing plugins and how important they were going to be in upcoming versions of Rails, and I thought, well, the wiki just isn't really going to help. As more and more plugins come out, it's just going to get more and more nasty. And so, over that weekend, while we were there at that conference, I whipped together the first version of the plugin directory, and I really did it out of kind of a selfish notion because I wanted to keep up with what was going on with all the plugins. I wanted to know who was doing what and what kind of code was out there. So I figured, well, if I built this repository and I, you know, had to administer it, then I would keep my thumb on the pulse of plugin development. And so it kind of started out that way, and I figured it would be a good resource for others too, and it has been. It's I think done wonders for helping people know what's already out there, what's code that's available that can save me a lot of time, and that's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, and for the listeners, you can find that at agilewebdevelopment.com. Now, why did you choose agilewebdevelopment.com as opposed to like plugin directory or something like that?
When I first started the site, it wasn't actually going to be just plugins. It was going to be a bit more community stuff and like linking in articles about using Rails to help with agile development. And at first, I did actually have I was maintaining feeds of interesting blog posts about Rails and things like that. Over time, there were other great resources that came out, like Ruby Inside and other just wonderful curated sites that I couldn't keep up with. And so I just limited myself over time more and more to just the plugins stuff. So, the domain name isn't a great match to exactly what it is, but humble beginnings and slightly slight pivot along the way.
All right. Yeah. And you know, yeah, I think I just thought it was funny because, you know, I come to this site and I'm kind of expecting this, website on agile web development. And it turned out that it was a Rails plugins directory. Now, how do you find out about new plugins? Do you depend on the community to report them, or do you go out and look for them? Or is there some script in the back end that goes and looks them up? Or how do you do that?
I do depend on the community and plugin authors to report them. That's very helpful. And also, I read a lot of blogs about Rails, and so I'm RubyFlow is a great source of picking up little tidbits about people that release new gems and new plugins. So I'll watch those things and keep track on my GitHub feed of the people that I watch, and then that helps me add some more plugins as well. But having the plugin authors themselves contributing is really what makes the plugin directory work well.
Yeah, that's awesome. And hopefully we can get more people telling you about more good stuff that they're building in.
Yeah, it's really helpful. It's been neat a lot of times as I've talked to other Rails developers and they want to do problem X or they need solution Y. And I can say, oh, yeah, there's a plugin for that. Mm-hmm. You know, before there was an app for that, there was a plugin for that. And it makes it really easy to get stuff built with Rails. It's nice.
Right. Now, it seems like a lot of the things that people are building into Rails these days comes in gems versus plugins.
Uh-huh.
Do you have any opinion as far as, you know, which way is the best way or even... Well, I'll let you answer that.
Sure. Before Bundler, I came down in favor of the plugin side just because it was easier at the time to have plugins distributed with your app.
Mm-hmm.
The whole gem management thing was just kind of tough. Although I always preferred being able to do the nice versioning that gem has always had. And I was one of those that thought, well, with the plugins, why reproduce what the gem system is doing poorly?
Right.
But with Bundler, it's no question in my mind the gem is a better way to go. It's the versioning is there, the ease of distribution with your app is there. I mean, it's great.
So do you have any intention then of maybe adding some gem support to agilewebdevelopment.com?
I have listed plugins that are basically distributed as gems. Mm-hmm. And I'm open to suggestions on how to make the plugin directory better for that. I haven't really come up with a great idea myself on how to represent that better. So for now, I'm listing repositories for gems just like I've always listed the ones for plugins. And so far, that's worked okay, but if anyone has any suggestions, I'd be happy to hear them.
All right. And what's the best way for people to let you know what their suggestions are?
You can always drop me an email, ben@bencurtis.com.
All
right. I'm also available on Twitter as Stimpy.
Can you spell that out?
STYMPY.
All right. And, how active are you on Twitter and some of these other social media platforms?
I try to get more work done than play in my overall day. But I do watch Twitter daily and Facebook, not so much. But, of course, email, I'm always on top of that.
Right. Now, I'm also wondering about Testly.
Uh-huh.
It looks like it's a tool to help manage your tests. I didn't quite understand what it's about.
Yeah. Testly was a project that I launched way back, I guess, 2001 or so. And it was meant for testers and software developers kind of working together. A tester would go in and record what their test plans are, because most development shops that have actual QA people, they tend to have a test plan that they create and then follow as they're testing your software. So this wasn't initially for automated testing. It was more for the manual testing that a QA tester might do. And the fun thing that was about Tesly was I originally built it in PHP, and it was the first project that I did in Rails that was a real project. And for me, it was a great way to learn, and I recommend anyone do this. You know, if you're learning Rails, or if you want to learn whatever, Node, or you know, whatever the flavor of the day is, take a project that you've already done and redo it, because you already know the logic behind it. You already know how you want things to work, and so then your only pain point is the new syntax or the new approach that it provides, and not necessarily also trying to figure out your problem domain. So anyway, that's just an aside, but it was a great learning experience for me to take Tesly from PHP to Rails, and then it evolved into Tesly Junior as the Rails testing frameworks made it really easy to hook in, like with TestUnit. Then I could report automated testing into Tesly, and so you could lay out your test plan, or you could actually have your Rails app automatically report the results of your test run. And the thought then was, then you can have your clients looking at that and saying, oh, I can see that. Here's the tests that are being run, and I don't have to go and look somewhere for that. And everything is green. Since then, I haven't been really involved in QA teams. I've been working solo, doing consulting. And so I haven't maintained the app very much. In fact, it's kind of in hibernation mode. It has some current users, but I'm not taking more users. And, you know, testing frameworks like Cucumber now make it really easy to report to clients on the kind of tests that you're running.
Mm-hmm.
So that aspect of it isn't really needed so much anymore.
That
so it was
sense.
Some fun project, but not one that I'm actively working on.
You know, it's interesting that you you talk about that, though. I mean, I was talking to Peter Cooper this morning, and you've mentioned a couple of his websites, Ruby Flow and Ruby Inside. And, you know, he talked about scratching your own itch, and it sounds like that's what Tezli was more or less about. You know, there you saw a problem, or you had the problem, and then you went ahead and put something together that fixed the problem. You know, and that's what he's done with some of his things, and you know, it's really been inspiring to me too to go, okay, well, you know, I have this problem, you know, or I really wish that I could do this, and then, you know, be able to turn around and actually manage that and set it up. So, you know, I have a few projects in me that are probably gonna, you know, come out within the next little while, even though I'm pretty busy myself. You know, and it's because of people like you and Peter that, you know, talk about this and you know, kind of give us that, you know, that idea of, hey, I have a problem and I know how to fix it. I have the tools.
Sure. Yeah, I definitely advocate that. I mean, that's the source of most of my project ideas, the own pain points that I have. I mean, that's why I did the Faker gym, because I needed some fake data. That's why I built Catch the Best, because I was managing a team of developers and designers and I needed to hire people. And I'm not an HR person, and it's a painful experience to manage all that out of your inbox. That's why I built Upload Juicer, you know, because I thought it'd be pretty cool to have image magic out there somewhere in the cloud that I didn't have to worry about doing it on my thing and dealing with large uploads. And sometimes these itches that you scratch, sometimes they are, you know, you do that and it works out well from an economic standpoint, and sometimes it doesn't. You know, I mean, Tezli, it helped me and what I needed then, but it wasn't really a great economic success, I would say. But you know, Catch the Best and Rails kits have been. Upload Juicer, it's still too early to say, I think. But so sometimes you just get the personal satisfaction of having the problem solved, and sometimes you get the benefit of making some money out of it too, which is great.
So now I'm a little curious. I recently got laid off and I've started my own consulting thing, and so I'm going to probably ask you about that. But Catch the Best kind of gets my interest as well. What did you find, what did you find that really helps managers make good decisions as far as who they're hiring?
I found when I was in the hiring role as a CTO, what I found was I would put out a job ad and I would get, you know, 100 or so resumes, and the thing that I found was that after I looked at, you know, 30 or 40 resumes, I could look at a resume and within a minute I could tell whether or not I really want to spend more time with that resume, with that person. I could tell based on what they listed or how they, and frankly, how they wrote their cover letter, how much interest they had in what I was hiring for and whether they would be a good fit for my team. I could just, after a while, I just got really good at seeing that really quickly. So Catch the Best, I figured if I could have a way to have that same experience where, you know, the cover letter's right there, the resume is right there in my face, and I could do that with my team, then I could go through those resumes more quickly, and I could also, you know, say, ask my teammates to do it with me, rather than having it come to my inbox and I have to be the first filter and then pass that around to people. And so that was actually the whole motivation behind Catch the Best, was to get that resume up front. And so I use Scribd, because they have that inline preview, which is fantastic. So the cover letter is there, the resume is there. You don't have to download an attachment. You don't have to open stuff.
Right.
And then all my team members have access, and so they can all get in there and they can thumb up or thumb down a particular individual, and I can save my time on who I'm looking at.
Oh, nice.
So that, I don't know if that answered your question, but that's where I was.
Well, I think that is kind of a valuable thing, and I've talked to several people about hiring practices, and you know, most of the time it's the manager just looks at the stuff. You know, makes a decision on what he saw there. I mean, it can be anything from gut feel to, you know, a specific set of criteria that they're looking for. And, you know, and then they make the decision on who comes onto the team. And so I kind of like the approach of the team being able to go in and say, hey, you know, this is the kind of guy we want to work with, and this is the kind of guy we don't want to work with. Because because ultimately then what you're doing is you're allowing your experts, your developers, to basically determine what their work environment's going to be, at least in one more aspect. And, you know, if you keep your experts there, and as they work for you, they also become domain experts in whatever domain they're working in, you know, ultimately then you can keep the resource that, you know, basically feeds your company because, you know, they're building the product.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally believe in getting everyone, especially in the hiring scenario, getting everyone on the team involved, because you have different personalities in a team and you guys are presumably already working well together.
Mm-hmm.
And so you want to add someone to your team that will fit in pretty naturally. You don't have to have an exact clone of someone else you already have on your team. But, you know, if your designer is something sets that designer off about the person that you're talking to, you know, they know they're not gonna be able to work with that person. Well, then there's no point in hiring that person, even if they're fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You know, so for someone who's, you know, out there applying for jobs, I would say some of the critical things are spend some time on your cover letter. Honestly, really. I mean, show some interest, not just, hey, I'm applying for your job. But actually show some interest in the job that you're applying for. You know, customize your resume. Don't, you know, if you're applying for a Rails job, you know, don't send me a whole bunch of Java stuff. You know, tell me about your Java experience, but don't spend, you know, 5 pages on that.
Right.
And be yourself, you know, because it is a big social fit when you're talking about getting a new hire or getting into a new position. And there's no point in lying about who you are. That's not going to help you 3 months later, you know, when you're in that job. So be yourself, be natural, and show the person they're actually interested.
Mm-hmm. I think those are all excellent tips. I mean, I've been the team lead, you know, not on a big team, but, you know, I've been there, and yeah, you know, I was director of support at Mosey, and, you know, managed like 30 people, and, you know, every time I'd have to hire, I mean, you would be shocked at the people who apply for some of these jobs, and, you know, yeah, I mean, something like this would have been really nice to just be able to, you know, okay, you know, no.
Exactly.
You know, and, you know, eventually, I mean, we started putting other things in place, you know, where they had to fill out an application, or, you know, we gave them an exam and things like that. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, you press them in different ways to see how they react, because, you know, you have to know who you're bringing in. And,
right.
You know, at the same time, yeah, I had one guy that totally misrepresented who he was and what he was capable of doing. And, you know, we wound up having to let him go and, you know, didn't do him any favors, didn't do us any favors, you know,
mm-hmm.
In the end, you know, I escorted him out and I was just as frustrated as he was.
Right.
And, yep. You know, so, yeah, I mean, it's really interesting, you know, and I think you've given a lot of good advice for our listeners if you're out looking for a job. I'm also curious, though, you've been in business for yourself for, it looks like, the last 3 years.
Yeah.
How does that work for you? I mean, you know, do you spend a lot of time doing client work, or is most of your income from the, you know, from these other sites that you have up, Rails kits and stuff? And how do you manage all of that?
I guess it's probably about half and half. As far as income goes, my time allotment kind of goes back and forth, so I can't accurately say how much time I spend on all the various projects versus client work, because that, you know, that varies too much. But I really enjoy consulting. I think that even you know, I could probably do just fine with all the projects, but the consulting work gives me a variety of things to work on, which I really enjoy. It's
mm-hmm.
one of the big pros for me of being a freelancer is being able to work on new stuff on a regular basis. I get bored even with my own stuff, so I like having new things to work on. My freelancing started back in 2007. The startup I was working for shut down,
mm-hmm.
and you know, I had some work. I was doing some moonlighting on the side, and so I figured, well, it's a good time to give it a shot, you know. So I reached out to the people I was already working for and told them I had more time if they had more money. And so that's how I started on freelancing. And since then, it's been a lot of fun. I mean, it's a whole new world of stress from going from a salary guy and expecting a paycheck to show up every month versus making sure you have money to show up every month. That's a totally different world. But it's a lot of fun. I really enjoy it. I enjoy being able to work on new ideas. You know, I've got clients that come to me with, you know, all kind of random ideas, and it's fun to take those and see those turn to reality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been interesting for me, and I've only been doing this for 2 weeks now, and, you know, it's a lot of fun just talking to people about, you know, kind of their dreams and ideas, you know, and,
mm-hmm.
and the things that they're working on. And, you know, I definitely like the aspect of being able to change things up, but, you know, my wife and I are still getting used to the idea of, you know, I don't get the exact same amount every couple of weeks. And, you know, being able to more or less count on that money. But at the same time, you know, one thing that I've felt over the last little while, I mean, in the last 3 years, I've been laid off twice because the companies either couldn't find enough work or make enough sales, you know, and they bring it in and they, you know, heads hanging. We're real sorry, but, you know, I mean, one of them was a consulting and they just, for some reason, they didn't know how to sell Ruby on Rails. So, you know, that was pretty much that, you know, so.
Yeah. When the company shut down, there were five of us that were laid off that day, tiny startup, but you know, the money ran out. And, I thought, you know, I can either put my eggs in someone else's basket or I can make my own basket. And, and as soon as I started freelancing is about when I also looked at, okay, well, what's a product that I can build to help offset the, you know, the fluctuations in income. And that's where Catch the Best, I thought, I looked back at my previous problems that I had, and Catch the Best was the first idea that came to me that I thought would work. And so as I dove into freelancing, I also dove into building my own product line. And I think that that's really helpful if you can do that to help even out those fluctuations in cash flow. They definitely happen. But yeah, it's, you're looking at risk one way or the other. Either you're putting your eggs in someone else's basket and hoping that, you know, they can manage their business well enough to keep you employed, or you have to go out and hustle yourself. Someone's got to hustle, so you just take your choice of who it's going to be, you know?
Yeah, it was actually interesting because Miles Forrest, because I tweeted, you know, because I got a job offer about a week into freelancing, and, you know, so I tweeted out there and I'm like, I got this job offer and it's something that I really, you know, the salary was fair and, you know, it looked really good. The company looked really, really good, looked really stable. And, you know, but I was really enjoying freelancing and there's just some appeal to me to be able to work for myself. And so anyway, Miles Forrest tweeted back and he said, well, what do you value more, stability or flexibility? Because, you know, your full-time job represents stability and your freelancing represents flexibility. And, you know, having been laid off twice within the last 3 years, you know, because they either couldn't manage to find work or they weren't managing their money well and they were running out. That's what happened this last time. You know, I really am a little leery about saying that full-time work really represents that stability. Right. You know, it to me, it seems like a full-time job represents consistency more than stability. You know, you get the same paycheck, you have the same benefits, you put the same amount into your 401k, you know, you do all of the things, you go to work for about the same amount of time every week, you know, and so it's all very consistent, very smooth. But, you know, if the company's not stable, then you don't have any more stability than if you were out freelancing on your own.
Right.
And, oh, go ahead.
Yeah. The flexibility is really the key. It's, you know, people talk about the lifestyle business and being a freelancer is basically a lifestyle business, you know, unless you decide, well, I'm going to build an agency and I'm going to, you know, structure it so that I'm not actually working anymore. And I'm got my employees doing all the work. But you know, it's like being a dentist or, you know, something. You have that lifestyle where you can choose how you spend your time. Well, I can either make, you know, work myself to death and make a ton of money, or I can, you know, go out and ride my bike every day at 3 p.m., you know? And it's neat to be able to have that flexibility. And it's, frankly, a luxury that we enjoy because of the technology to get to work with. It's just amazing.
Yeah, and it's true. You know, you talk about starting an agency or something and, you know, it was funny because I've had a few people say, well, just hire some guys to write some of the code that you need written. And I'm just like, but I like writing the code, you know? And it is. It's choosing where you want to be, you know, that niche. You know, do you want to sit in the seat where you're writing the code? Do you want to sit in the seat where you're trying to sell the jobs? Do you want to do both? You know, and there's a lot of give and take that you definitely have to, you know, have in that business because you're going to wind up doing some things that you don't particularly want to do just to keep the business running. But, you know, yeah, I mean, we've been working things out so that I can spend, I think I've spent more time with my family this week than I have ever being employed. So, you know, and the other interesting thing was that, you know, I looked at the, you know, my billing rate and taxes and everything. And, you know, I figured out that, you know, not only do I get more flexibility and stuff, but I'm actually making more money doing freelance than I ever was, you know, as an employee. And so that's nice there because, you know, my wife and I have been wanting to put together an emergency fund and things like that for a while. And it looks like now we're going to be in a position to do that. So, you know, it's just been a fascinating and interesting ride. I'm a little curious, what do you do to actually find freelance work?
Most of my work, honestly, comes from client referrals. So typically, you know, I'll have a client that I do a project for, and a few months later they'll come back and say, oh, well, it's such and such that I know they want to do a project too. And they make the introduction, and I do that. So I guess I don't have a lot of advice for finding work because work typically finds me.
Okay.
For which I'm very grateful. But also, what really helps, to be honest, is just being visible. I blog, not as much as I used to, but I blog, and that helps people, you know, realize that, hey, this guy knows what he's talking about. He knows what he's doing. I don't have to worry that he's just some some faker. You know, he actually understands Rails and he understands how to build projects. And, you know, talking at conferences is great just to have some visibility and participating in the community. And then, of course, I also enjoy going out to networking events. Here in Seattle, we have a pretty cool startup scene. We have, like, the Seattle Tech Startups mailing list where a bunch of us hang out. We have NPost events and Tech Cafe events and things that we can go to. And I just love hanging out with you know, people who are also doing the entrepreneur thing. And that helps, too, just to people who know who you are. And it's not that I'm out there, you know, saying, hey, do you have some work for me to do? But just, hey, this is who I am. This is what I do. If I can help you anytime, just let me know, kind of stuff. So those are, you know, traditional, tried and true ways. I think the key is to always be, well, not necessarily always be closing, but definitely always be selling. You always need to be having your head up a little bit to be aware of projects that are available. Maybe you're just starting out and you don't know anybody yet, and so you're just watching Craigslist or you're watching, you know, Odesk or whatever. Making sure that you budget your time for your sales activity, whatever it is. Maybe me, it's just answering emails, or maybe it's putting together bids on projects. But you got to make sure you spend some time doing that rather than just being buried in the code all the time. Otherwise, you'll look up and all of a sudden your project's done and you don't have any work to do.
Right. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Have you found that clients are usually pretty good about, you know, waiting until you finish your current project? You know, I need a few months or a few weeks.
Yes, people are generally pretty flexible. Although I personally don't commit myself 100% to any one project at a time, so that I do have time to at least talk to somebody else about the project and give them some guidance on how to get started and stuff like that. So I always make sure that I have some slack in my schedule to be able to say, oh, I'm not available today, but we can start, you know, maybe in 2 months. And between now and then, let's talk about what you want to do and we can start figuring out how it's going to work.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. And then I like that approach as well because, yeah, then you keep your options open until you can pick things up and run with them.
Yep.
All right. Well, you know, this has been really just fascinating to talk to you and, you know, kind of figure some of this stuff out. One other thing that I've really been curious about, it looks like you've been blogging a little bit about like Redis and some of the NoSQL stuff. I haven't had a lot of time to play with it, but I'm really tempted with some of my projects. It seems to make a whole lot more sense to use like MongoDB or something as opposed to MySQL.
Sure.
So I'm a little curious, what's your opinion on the various NoSQL solutions that you've used, and when do you think they would be appropriate as opposed to a SQL solution like MySQL?
I'm a long time, I'm a database guy. Most of the training that I have in the tech world, the official training, was on the database side. And so I'm a big believer in SQL, relational databases, and that kind of stuff. And I look at when I look at a new project, I'm looking first at, you know, what are the relationships, what are the models, and that's how kind of how I view the world. So the NoSQL or the schemaless databases or document stores or what have you, those are all interesting to me. And I think, and they're fun to play with. I think part of, as a freelancer and as an employee, I think you have to make sure that you spend some time just playing with stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, I played with Node and I dabbled with other, you know, Python or whatever. You just got to have some time to play. And so what I've done is I've played with Mongo and I've played with Couch and Redis, and I think they're all great. I think you have to balance two things. One, what kind of data are you going to be dealing with? And so, you know, let the modeling, your data needs determine what kind of solution you go with. Mm-hmm. And then two, what and this is the can be the trickier part. What's the infrastructure story? So I'm gonna just give an example. So I had a project where I was dealing with a lot of different data. It was all like product data, like, you know, T-shirts or coats, mm-hmm. or whatever. But it was coming from a bunch of different vendors, and so the data was not normalized because, you know, one guy had, you know, sizes done this way, another guy had colors done that way. And I thought Mongo would be a great solution for that because I could just, I knew it was a varying set of data, and so I could just put it into Mongo and not have to deal with making sure everything was common, everything was normalized. Mm-hmm. And that worked out well. But the problem was, this was, I'm going to give a caveat, this was early Mongo. This is pre-1. Mm-hmm. So the hitch was, though, that, of course, Mongo being much, much younger than MySQL, for comparison's sake, the whole backup story and deployment story was much different. And you kind of had to figure all that out on your own. You know, I hosted EngineYard Cloud. I love them. But when I was starting this project, you know, Mongo wasn't well supported, not nearly as well supported as MySQL, for example, as far as, you know, doing backups and data recovery and that kind of thing. So while I think some of these stores are great for working with your data, especially, you know, depending on what kind of modeling you want to do, you do need to also consider what's the deployment story going to look like. If I'm supporting this app, what's it going to take to make sure that I don't lose data? You know,
right.
and luckily Mongo has come a long way since the pre-1 days as far as that goes. But I say, yeah, you know, go for it. Play with stuff. Try it out. Spend some time, even on a client project. And I bill by the project, not by the hour, so I can afford to play with stuff and not feel guilty about, you know, charging them for something that may be playtime. But yeah, play with something. See how it works. And then if you like it, you know, think it through to the end. Okay, how is this going to look in production when I have to support it? And that, you know, if you look back at, like, one of the posts I had about Redis, you know, the EngineYard blog was about, use this for modeling your friend relationships. And that's great and all, but if you're just introducing it for that one little thing, okay, maybe you need to think through about how that's going to work with the rest of your deployment. Maybe it's not worth the trouble. Maybe it is, but it's an individual thing. You have to evaluate that.
Hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, and I'm actually looking at your post on Redis mm-hmm. right now, and... Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, it's an interesting exploration into this particular problem.
Yeah.
You know, and I like the idea of, you know, spending time getting to know new technologies and stuff, and uh-huh. and I definitely plan on looking into Mongo and some of these other databases. You know, I've heard great things about Redis as far as you know, replacement for some other technologies and things like that. And yeah, I mean, there are so many possibilities with all of these new technologies, and, you know, I think we all do ourselves a disservice by, you know, just sticking to what, you know, the ones we know. I mean, we definitely need to have expertise in what we're using, but that doesn't mean that we need to use what we have expertise in.
Right.
So, anyway, it looks like we're almost out of time, but, you know... I really, really appreciate you coming onto the podcast, and, you know,
thanks for having me.
Yeah, I've learned a lot of new things, and I'll probably be pestering you over and over again as I have questions about some of this stuff.
You're welcome to. You know, I always invite people to drop me an email, ask me questions about, you know, whatever I'm doing, projects that I'm doing, or freelancing in general. I've had a number of people take me up on that, and I love answering what questions I can. So yeah, feel free.
All right, so if you want to pester Ben too, you can go to bencurtis.com. You can also go to tesly.com. That's TESLY.com. If you want to hire him, that's a good place to find information. You know, some of the other things we talked about, I'll put links to in the show notes. You can also follow him on Twitter as Stimpy, STYMPY. And are there any other good ways of finding you?
That's about it.
All right. Well, thanks again for coming on to the podcast.
My pleasure.
All right. Well, we'd like to thank Ben for coming onto the podcast. It's always great to talk to people like him. And, you know, there were a lot of things that were really inspiring. And, you know, we had a good discussion afterward, too. And, you know, I just really, again, want to thank him for coming onto the podcast. And I want to thank June and all the other people who kind of helped us find each other so that we could do the interview. And, you know, finally, I just, you know, want to remind you to go check out our sponsors, www.newrelic.com and chargeify.com. And finally, you can get the show notes at teachmetocode.com/podcast. And remember to take the survey, teachmetocode.com/survey. And that'll do it. Thanks.